Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and the only place to hear the much anticipated, never duplicated Duff McKagan joke of the week. No!
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan, calling you from San Antonio, Texas, on tour still, you know. Hope you're doing well. Hope everybody out there is doing well. Listen, my friend Tony asked me not to say his name backwards. I said, why not? Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That was a good one. My wife didn't get it, but it was a good one. Must be something in the water there in San Antonio, Texas. Thanks to Duff for delivering the laughs, even while on tour with Guns N' Roses. GunsN'Roses.com if you want to pick up tickets to see them live. And you can pick up tickets to see Fozzy live as well. Spotlight on North America starts October 19th in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is, by the way, when our new single, Spotlight, will be released. We're coming to Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska before we wrap up this leg November 6th in Memphis, Tennessee. Go to FozzyRock.com and see all the dates and for all ticket information. Of course, we're doing our famous VIP meet and greet. It's the best in the business. We meet you, take pictures, play a private set for you, even let you sing if you want to. Go to FozzyRock.com to get all your tickets. And also, too, Fozzy coming back to the UK as well. Spotlight on the UK kicks off February 16th in Newport, Wales. Tickets to the show and to the meet and greets are available now, also at FozzyRock.com. All right, today on the show, we're visiting Zach Bagan's Haunted Museum in Las Vegas. Tis the season to be scary. Let's keep it going with one of the creepiest museums I've ever visited. I've got the Haunted Museum's longest tenured tour guide, Virginia, along with museum general manager Richard Hunter, and they're walking us through the museum, telling stories about some of the most active items and exhibits in the mansion, sharing their own personal paranormal experiences with the various artifacts. We've got the transaxle from actor James Dean's cursed Porsche 550 Spider. Talk about its storied and evil history. They got the Peggy doll, which has caused terror to many guests who take the tour. You hear about the infamous Dybbuk box, the devil's rocking chair, which inspired The Conjuring 3. And of course, Dr. Jack Kevorkian's Volkswagen van. He's the doctor who pioneered physician-assisted suicide. He's got the van where he's committed those acts, I guess you'd say. The Haunted Museum is a whole room dedicated to haunted and possessed Hollywood artifacts like actor Brandon Lee's jacket that he wore during the filming of The Crow, actress Sharon Tate's wedding dress, who's probably the most famous victim of the Manson family, the chair that was next to Michael Jackson's bed, his deathbed. You got the serial killer room with artifacts from John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, Ed Gein. Also sharing the history of the mansion itself, which was built in 1938, and at one point in the 70s was rumored to be the site of devil-worshipping rituals and human sacrifice. So come get creeped out on the Zach Bagan's Haunted Museum tour with Virginia and Richard Hunter and a cameo from Zach himself right here, right now on Talk is Jericho.
All right, so we are here, Zach Bagan's Haunted Museum. And I came here a few months ago with my kids, and this place kind of super blew my mind. It's not just a, you know, tourist attraction, shall we say. There's some real creepy stuff going on in there. We're not actually in the museum right now, but we're kind of next door in a just as creepy area. What would you call this place, Richie?
This is Zach's Black House. We call it the Black House. And I tell you what, Chris, not a lot of people see the inside of this place. So
I'm lucky.
You are. You are. This place has seen some pretty exclusive company, but it is not. It's not on the tour. It's not part of the museum, so it's VIPs only, or RIPs as we call them here.
So does Zach work in here?
Yeah, he doesn't live here, but films in here some. If you watch our series Haunted Museum, which is on Discovery Plus, new season's going to be coming out here in the fall. A date should be announced for it any day to debut. I would guess probably sometime around Halloween time. But a lot of the wraparounds in that show, the intros that Zach does, if you watch, are filmed in here.
So, Virginia, you've worked here, you said, for about 5 years.
A little over 5.5 years.
And you are one of the actual guys. And Richard, are you kind of like the manager here?
I'm the general manager, okay. Yes. Somebody put me in charge of this place. So
fools.
I don't know what they were thinking. No.
But Virginia, you're one of the guides.
Yes.
And you were here when we went through with the tour. And it seems to me that you have a little bit of an affinity to have a feeling for the energy that's in the Haunted Museum. I don't know if it's would be an empath or whatever that would be.
Yeah,
but you definitely, you feel what's going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the reasons why you were attracted to come work here in the first place? Or is it something that you discovered while you were working here?
I've always been fascinated by the paranormal, and I've had paranormal experiences before I worked here. And then when I started working here, there were people on my tour. It was a daily basis where somebody would lose consciousness or throw up or have nosebleeds. And Zach was like, "What is going on with your tours?" He goes, "You're like a magnet for this stuff." And I thought, oh my God, I had no idea. But it's to the point now to where I can walk into the museum and you can just feel, man, I bet Zach added something, or he went into the basement and did something just to poke the bear. And, you know, it's just that feeling you get.
Now, is the museum itself, I know because Zach's been on this show before, is this one of the buildings that he's bought that has some sort of a history? Or
oh yeah,
so tell us about the actual museum building itself, because there's a basement down there that you just feel a lot of heaviness and creepy vibes. So what exactly is this place?
So the Haunted Museum was originally the Wengert Mansion. Cyril Wengert, who was an early developer here in Las Vegas, built the home for his family in 1938. So it's all closing in on 100 years old, the house is. His family lived there until the 1970s, and then it was also abandoned for quite a bit of time. And that's where rumors started, rumors that were since in the last few years confirmed by one of the family members who was living in the home at that time throughout the 1970s, that there were devil-worshipping rituals, rumors of human sacrifice, things occurring down in the basement. And so the museum, it's been the Haunted Museum since 2017, so October is going to be 6 years for us. But Zach bought the house specifically with the museum in mind,
in mind, right?
Not only that, he's told me this story several times. You know, he knew he wanted a location for a museum. Nothing was feeling right. Few deals fell through. And this particular house at 600 East Charleston, the old historic Wengert Mansion, he said he didn't even realize it was available. But when he walked into it, not only did he get goosebumps, not only did he immediately feel the energy of it, but he knew that this had always been his house. That makes sense. Like, you know, on the astro plane, this had he lived here before he lived here, kind of thing. And like Virginia said, anytime Zach comes to the museum, and I get this question a lot, you know, people say, well, does Zach ever come to the museum? You know, sometimes you see a celebrity license their name to something, they're not that involved. Quite the opposite with Zach. He's here, he's in and out all the time. If he's not filming, there's nothing in the museum down to a candle on a table that he didn't put right there, right? And anytime he's in here, he goes down to the basement. He has certain things in the Necronomicon he likes to read from, and it always stirs stuff up. I think, you know, you can always just kind of, even if you didn't know he had been here, you'd be like, what's going on today? Was Zach here earlier this morning, yesterday? What happened? You know,
right.
Sure enough, that always seems to be the case.
So tell us about, I mean, like I said, there's so much in there. It takes about, I don't know, 2.5 hours to go through the entire place and get the entire tour. Talk to us about, and I want to ask you about some certain things as well. Tell us about some of the artifacts that are in there that are a little bit more, shall we say, evil than others.
The one that I have the most issues with is the divvy box. and it seems like it's getting a lot more in that room for me lately. I'll see things. People just feel really weird in that room on my tour. Some people feel really nauseous and sick in that room, but it just seems like it's getting worse up there for me. I don't tell management every single time something, because they're probably going to be like, oh man, again, man, what is going on up there with Virginia? You know, because I had an incident where I exited the Dybbuk box room. It was just a few weeks ago, and I was presenting Peggy's room, and something pushed me from the side, and I ran into the woman next to me, and I was like, but there's nobody next to me, and I felt a hand on my shoulder.
Actually felt something push you.
I did, and I looked at the woman, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, and then I felt something hit my hand. My flashlight, it flew out of my hand and hit the woman in front of me. And I was like, holy crap, what the hell? And then everybody on the tour saw it. Everyone on the tour saw it. And they were like, was that Peggy? Was that Peggy? And they asked, Peggy, was that you? And we hear, yup. From the spirit box. I was like, oh my God.
We should explain, too. Peggy is the haunted doll that lives in the room next door to the Dybbuk box. So they're neighbors.
Like, great. Now Peggy's coming out.
And you're not supposed to, is Peggy the one that you're not supposed to look at in the eyes?
Yes.
Right. So before we get to Peggy, because that was an interesting one, what exactly is a Dybbuk box?
The Dybbuk box is a wine cabinet that, her name is Havila. She was a Holocaust survivor, and she fled Nazi Poland, and she wound up in Spain, and she believes a Dybbuk followed her from the concentration camp. Dybbuk is a Jewish word meaning demon. She had seances to capture that Dybbuk in the wine cabinet, and that's exactly what she did. There's a certain way that you seal a Dybbuk in a box. I personally, I'm afraid to look up how to do it. It's like, I don't want to dabble in that because I already have problems in there, so I don't want to find out. But some people have told me that it's like you seal it with like hot wax, and then you say some things around it to seal the Dybbuk, but it is a demon.
The box had passed through several owners as well since the Holocaust survivor had it, and those two guys didn't want anything to do with it either. It's interesting, a lot of the artifacts at the museum, some of them, sure, Zach seeks out and wants to exhibit them, and he's got a fascination with it. You'd be surprised how many items come to him because somebody says, I don't want this. Mm-hmm. You know, not only do I not want it, the person who owned it before doesn't want it. Here, you take it, deal with it, and, you know, this is the home for that sort of thing.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So where would Zach find, you know, a Dybbuk box, so to speak? He mentions people sometimes give him stuff. Does he also scour the planet looking for some of these? Because there's stuff that we'll talk about I can't even believe that actually owns.
Yeah.
But for like a Dybbuk box, like you just don't go to like, you know, Dybbuk boxes or us and then pick one up off the shelf.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's very true. Yes, I mean, both. You know, it's he's always got his eye out for those things. You know, some of these artifacts really had infamous reputations even before they came to the Haunted Museum. The Dybbuk box was one. The Devil's Rocking Chair was another one, you know. Sometimes it's once he's approached about an item, he already knows the history very well. In fact, just not to get ahead of you, but at some point I've got some, I'll give you a little exclusive. We've got a new item coming to the Haunted Museum. Virginia doesn't even know what this is yet. So I'm going to tell you first what we've got coming here in another month or so. But it is something that has a very storied history with it like that. Yeah. So, you know, it's people know that Zach is the go-to guy for that sort of thing. So yeah. A lot of times people are reaching out. I don't think it takes too much scouring on his part, because a lot of these items, not only do they come to him, they just sort of seem to find their way here.
And I had that experience with the cursed Dennis Hoff Lamar Odom bed that's here in the house.
You mentioned that in your email. Tell me a little bit about
that. So this is when I knew this place was for real, if I didn't know it before. Before I worked here at the Haunted Museum, I worked as a media director for Dennis Hoff, who was the guy that owned the Bunny Ranch and the Love Ranch and all the legal brothels in Nevada. And I was there in 2014, I guess it was, when Lamar Odom, the Lakers basketball player, the guy who was married to Khloe Kardashian, came in. He was spending 3 days there in the brothel in the VIP suite. And he had a series of strokes on this bed and nearly died. And I happened to be the person who found him and administered the CPR and called 911 and dealt with all that, which was, you know, I think most people, they go through their lives, they don't think anything like that's ever going to happen, where right. you're really staring death in the face. So that experience never left me. 3 years almost to the day that he had that series of strokes and almost died, Dennis Hoff, the owner of the brothel, did in fact die on that very same bed. So now, fast forward about a year later, I'm here working at the museum. There is no connection. Zach did not know Dennis. He did not know Lamar Odom. No connection to the brothels. Nothing. I come to work one day, and Zach says, "Hey, look what I got." And he shows me this bed. And I, of course, immediately recognize it because I gave a guy CPR on that bed. Right. But here's the thing. Zach did not know that. And I'm looking at the bed, this thing, I thought I'd never see that again in my life. And I said, "I got to tell you something." And I told him the story, and it just blew his mind, because he said that's what happens with him and these artifacts. In this instance, it happened with me. It's like something followed me here. You know, it's like a page from your dark past. If you're here at the museum long enough, one of those pages will show up.
Right. Let's go back to, was it Penny the doll?
Or Peggy.
Peggy. Let's talk about Peggy, because the story is, and the rule is, when you go into Peggy's room, it's a doll, but don't look at Peggy in the eyes. And my son looked Peggy in the eye and had a headache for the rest of the night. Now, whether that's here or there, but tell us a little about the story behind Peggy and why you shouldn't be looking at her in the face.
Peggy is a demon-possessed doll, and paranormal investigator Jane Harris from London, she owned Peggy, and she uploaded a video of Peggy, and almost immediately there was like 80 comments of people having severe abdominal pain, nosebleeds, heart palpitations. A lady even had a full-blown heart attack just by viewing Peggy online. Yeah. Peggy's no joke. I've seen that doll do some crazy stuff.
So what do you think? Is there a demon trapped inside of Peggy? Some kind of a spirit or something along those lines? Or
I do. I 100% do, because Peggy proved herself to me one time, because I would never do this, but I actually asked Peggy for a favor one time. There was a gentleman that came through the tour from the time he entered to almost to the very end of the tour. He was above and beyond rude, and he was just so out of line in every room. I put them in the Dybbuk box room, and I started the video. I ran over to Peggy's room, and I asked her for a favor. Shame on me, right? And I got that group down into the devil's rocking chair, and I started the video, closed the door. About a minute in, I heard the loudest bang. I was like, "Oh my God, she killed him." It was that loud.
Wow.
I opened the door, and the trim on the wall, the entire trim on the wall, looked like it had been ripped off, and it hit him.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, "Oh, are you okay?" That was insane. And I was like, "How am I going to call this into command?"
How do you call it into command?
I did. I was like, "Command, can you come out in the little foyer area?" And here I am holding this big thing, and they're like, "What happened?" And I was like, "Well, I'll tell you later what happened."
Peggy did me a favor.
Yeah.
So much other cool artifacts in there to discuss. The one that I would really, there's a lot, but
the axle, the transaxle from James Dean's Porsche.
Yeah.
And just the whole story behind that, obviously James Dean died in the wreck with mm-hmm. that transaxle axle. But the fact that it continued to be haunted for years to come. It's like a real life Christine or yeah. something along those lines. First of all, tell us a little bit about that transaxle. Second of all, how in the hell did Zach find this?
So this is actually a good example of a mainstream avenue. This mm-hmm. was up for auction. Zach was the high bidder, and boy was he. And
how much did that cost, do you think?
He paid he paid almost $400,000 for
wow.
it. The story behind the transaxle is that James Dean was a racing enthusiast. He was on his way to a race, and he was driving a very rare Porsche, and was killed in a head-on collision. But the transaxle from the car, and it's a big, you've seen it, Chris, it's a big piece of steel. Mm-hmm. It is the only known piece of the car to still exist. Mm-hmm. The rest of the car has vanished. That transaxle, after it was in the car that killed James Dean, was put into several other race cars, causing other deaths Gosh. And other very serious injuries. So again, one of those items that people tend not to want. You know, it because it had this incredible value, somebody was holding on to it. And it was also, lucky for us, easily verified because Porsche keeps, precise records. And the serial number is on the side of the things. It's a piece of steel. So Porsche themselves, they were able to validate its authenticity. But once Zach knew it was up for sale, and I remember he told me, he's like, we're getting it. And not maybe I'll be the, he's like, I will have that. And it's going in the museum. That's how he came to that. So sometimes these things, you know, if they have that kind of high profile provenance, then they're in these, exclusive auctions and things like that. And they'll come to him that way. Other times it can be a family member saying, hey, this belonged to my great grandfather, and here's the story. And Zach is very big on authentication and provenance, so anything that comes into the museum has been highly, highly vetted. Notarized letters, video testimony, receipts, documentation, anytime that type of thing is available, very big on
he that. Wants to make sure it's legit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Virginia, you mentioned the Devil's Rocking Chair. In another video that Richard sent me, there was one with the Dybbuk box, somebody who passed out and was freaked out. And then the other one was the Devil's Rocking Chair, where the lady actually said, get this thing out of here before somebody gets hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the Devil's Rocking Chair and some of the encounters that people have had with it in the museum.
Sometimes people walk in there and they just have a horrible feeling right off the bat. And then other people, the video will start and then they'll just pass out. They're fine through the whole entire tour, but they get in that room. We had two girls pass out at once in that room. One, boom, and then the other, boom. So it gets wild around here sometimes. It does.
I think also it's interesting how disorienting it is for the people that it affects. So like that video I sent you, I actually filmed that. I was the one doing mm-hmm. the interview with the lady. And, when this happens to guests at the museum, a lot of times if they pass out, when they come to, they're not aware of exactly where they are, what's happened. And sometimes it's a real challenge just to console them enough to be able to get them to the exit door. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself can be a process.
And what exactly is the Devil's Rocking Chair?
So you want to take that, Virginia? Because the story.
The Conjuring 3 movie, the mm-hmm. Devil Made Me Do It case, where in this little town, it was in Connecticut, right? Mm-hmm. Arnie Johnson. It's like the first murder in 150 years of the town's existence. there was a little boy, David Glatzel, and the family moved into this house, and he started acting really strange. And he just started not acting like himself and just doing and saying, and he said that he would see like an older man in a plaid shirt and jeans, which happened to be the Beast. It got to the point to where they contacted Ed and Lorraine Warren to come and help them because it got so bad for the young boy. And they performed an exorcism on the little boy. I think there was a priest, because they always had a priest there with them when they did things like this. But it's such a crazy story. I was just going to say,
it's one of the cases, one of the famous cases of Ed and Lorraine Warren, if you've ever heard of them, paranormal investigators. Yeah. And the latest version of the latest installment of the Conjuring series is actually based on the Devil's Rocking Chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Zach got that directly from David Gladstone's brother. So that came directly from the family. And we've had all kinds of activity with that chair since it's been here at the museum. In fact, when the exhibit opened, it was only open, a few days or a week.
Yeah.
And there was so much activity in there, Zach closed it. And it stayed closed for quite a while. It was very unusual to have an exhibit, you know, all set up at the museum, but the doors closed, just deemed to
because all of us were crying, and we didn't know why. Yeah. We didn't know that Zach was going to open up the Devil's Rocking Chair that day. I'm like, why am I crying? Why am I crying? And I look down the hall, and other tour guides are crying. I'm like, what in the hell is going on here? And then we're like, Zach is opening up the Devil's Rocking Chair. And I'm like, oh, my God.
So just uncontrollable crying?
Yeah, it was just, I didn't even know what was going on. And you look down and you see your coworkers crying, too. You're like, what is going on? And then we find out that he decided to open it. But there was so much activity in that room that he decided to make the executive decision of closing it for the rest of that day. It was nuts.
Yeah, you know, some people, Chris, are more sensitive to this type of thing than others. I mean, you know, every guy that works here doesn't necessarily have Virginia's experience, and every guest that comes through the door isn't necessarily always going to feel something. But I do believe that everybody feels energy, right? And to me, that's the great unifier here, is that everybody feels the energy of the artifact. You know, you're a musician. If you've ever held a famous guitar, it's like you can feel the notes that have, you're not playing those notes,
right?
But you feel the notes that have been played on that guitar before. And the bigger the legend, and the deeper the history, the more energy you're feeling from that guitar. And I liken that to the artifacts here at the museum. That's definitely what I feel.
And you can feel that, like some of the places I've been, you know, doing. I did a podcast in a haunted hotel in Kentucky, and we'd even go on Alcatraz and some of the areas there, and also too at the Haunted Museum. You can feel a heaviness in the air in some of those places, you know. And it's completely legit. It's not like, oh, whatever. Like, you feel a different vibe when you're around something that has some of that activity and some of that power.
I've seen people go into the museum with a really cocky attitude, and then they come out and they have one foot on the fence because they're like, what the hell just happened? Right. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. If I can, I'll tell you a couple of stories dealing with that. There were three girls on my tour one time. They were very cocky. That's a nice word I'll use, cocky. And Gretchen the doll, she is in the first room. She's a RIP room where the haunted dolls are in a closet. And I told them Gretchen's story. You know, Gretchen's been compared to Robert the doll. And
who's Robert the doll?
Robert the doll is a doll in Key West, Florida.
Ah, right.
And yeah, that doll where you're supposed to ask permission before taking pictures of him and very, be very respectful. And Gretchen's been compared to him because the previous owners, Gretchen, they put her on the couch. And when they came back, she was across the room.
Wow.
Right? She would knock pictures off the wall. They would hear a child crying from a room that they would put her in, and they're a childless couple. They would go to open up the door and the crying would stop. But I told these three girls that story, and they deliberately went into the doll closet and was above and beyond rude. But guess what? One of them lost consciousness in the next room. Yes. I love that when that happens, because it's like, anything else you want to say while you're on the floor?
You love it when it happens because it proves...
I do, because it's just... I mean, I don't want anyone to get hurt.
Sure.
I will make sure they're okay, but I'm also the tour guide that's going to be like, man, I told you not to do that. Yeah. I told you not to do that.
And I think it's also appropriate to point out that... Because before I was the general manager here at the museum, I was a guest. I experienced it just like you did for the first time and was just amazed by it. And when I started talking to Zach about working here... You know, one of the first things he said to me was, he said, you know, nothing is staged anyway. Nothing is fabricated. All we're doing is just telling the stories. And he said, the rest takes care of itself. And truer words were never spoken, because almost immediately after working here, you see these things happen. And it also has to do, I think, with energy sometimes that people bring. You know, some people tend to just be bystanders or passengers and, you know, witnesses to it. And then some people, you know, like Virginia, that was in a story about somebody provoking something, but somebody, you know, another person may just be particularly sensitive to something. But it is so true. It's the stories are just, and they're told in an expert fashion by the guides. We're very particular about the guides here, making sure that everybody has every little detail down, that they provide you all the necessary information of the story, so that you don't necessarily need to know anything about background before you come in. You won't be lost. If you're hearing this going, well, I don't really know much about this sort of thing, don't worry, we'll get you up to speed if you're on the tour. But as far as the experiences, you know, we just tell the stories, and the experiences happen on their own. And they happen on a daily basis.
Oh,
this
my God,
is
yeah.
any given day here at the Haunted Museum.
Every day, not every day, but a lot of days, things happen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get leery. You're like, why is everything so quiet around here? This is weird.
Yeah. Is it mostly people, like you said, like if they're being shoved or if they're just feeling like they're passing out? Like, that is that sort of the things that happen to people that walk through there?
Yeah, and sometimes it'll be, I felt a tug on the back of my hair, or I think my arm is scratched. You know, I didn't do that. That was the very first thing I ever saw here. We have cameras. Every inch of the museum is covered with cameras. And you've seen some clips on, Ghost Adventures. There's a four-part quarantine episode that was done here during lockdown. You can see a lot of that as well. But anytime something happens, we go right to the footage. That's where I got the videos that I sent you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we look to make sure that somebody isn't just maybe looking to be on TV, or, right. You know, so if you tell me you got scratched, I'm going to wait and see, make sure you're not scratching yourself, something like that. But the very first thing, I've probably only been here a week or two, and going back to Peggy, we had put a tour group in Peggy's room, closed the door, and 30 seconds after the presentation started, this guy, and he was a big burly guy, I remember too, because he almost knocked people over when he came flying out of the door. But the door flew open, he came running out, and he was holding his forearm, and when he moved his hand and I shined my flashlight on it, he had bleeding streaks down his arm. First thing I did was went and looked at the camera, right? And the guy was just standing still. The guy, one hand was nowhere close to the arm. All of a sudden, he jumped, he looked at his arm, and bolted out the door.
I'm to the point now when I get scratched, I'm just like, oh, okay.
Just don't even bother
anymore. Not anymore.
I was going to ask you, for both of you guys, but especially you, Virginia, do you ever, like, when you go home, do you feel things sometimes follow you, or is things just in the museum, stay in the museum?
You know what? I have a routine that when I leave that I do every day. If I thought something followed me, I would ask for help immediately.
Who would you ask for help from?
I would ask Zach. I know he's got like so many religions and everything on speed dial, I'm sure.
Gotcha.
I'd be like, yeah, I need
someone
help.
Someone can come cleanse you or whatever it needs to
yeah.
be, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't have something follow me home because of my son. He's
sure.
severely handicapped. And then I have my 87-year-old dad that lives with us now.
You
so
don't want them in your house to begin with.
No, right? Absolutely not.
What's up,
absolutely
man?
Not.
Exactly. Let's talk about another thing I didn't even know existed. which was Dr. Kevorkian's van.
Yeah.
Now let's explain who Dr. Kevorkian is at first for people who might not remember, because about, I guess, 20 years ago, he was in the news, all the rage. Who exactly was Dr. Kevorkian?
So Jack Kevorkian was a pioneer of physician-assisted suicide. That is something that is legal in many states now.
Now.
Right.
At the time, it was not.
Exactly. But beginning in the 80s through the 90s, Jack Kevorkian was making news in his home state of Michigan because he was assisting terminally ill patients. These were people, typically, maybe they have like a Lou Gehrig's disease or something that's going to eventually completely paralyze them to the point that if they wanted to take their own life, they couldn't because their hands won't work. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Kevorkian invented an apparatus that would basically administer a lethal injection to a patient. It had a button that they could control. So we would put the button in their hand, they would hit the button, and that would begin the process. But because this was illegal, he was having to drive around in an old Volkswagen van, meet the patient, put the patient in the van, go to an undisclosed location, assist them, and then he would a lot of times put the body in a motel room, and then he would call law enforcement to come get the body. Couldn't do any of this with advance notice, of course, because he was, at least at that time, committing a crime. We have the actual van that Dr. Kevorkian was using. This is the van where countless patients passed away in. That van is inside the museum. Mm. It's in its own room. One of the most active exhibits in the museum, and interestingly enough, disproportionately active with females. Mm-hmm. Don't know why that is, but I'm telling you, I've been here 4 years now, and way more so with females.
Females will feel something? Or
they'll feel something. I mean, it, you know, like I said, it could be somebody. We've had examples of people passing out, but it could just be a touching. It could just be a, you know, a feeling. And then sometimes people, I think, will hear. So we do a late night flashlight tour on Fridays and Saturdays only. After the museum closes, we turn all the lights off. We only allow 20 people in the museum for the entire 90-minute tour, and it's self-guided. So we give you a flashlight. We basically say, hey, you're on your own. You can go anywhere you want. I find, I do a lot of those, work a lot of those. I find that a lot of people end up having really deep, sincere connections with that particular exhibit on those flashlight tours. And a lot of times it may be because, you know, they've had a loved one pass away from a terminal illness or something. But it's not just the feeling of it. They will tell me, because we allow spirit boxes and other paranormal equipment to be used on those tours, they will tell me about direct communications they have with relatives and you know, things that only that relative would know to say to them, for example. So those are people who go in and they sit alone with that van for, you know, 15, 20 minutes, something like that, with the door closed, and they come out with some really life-changing experiences.
There's a lot of people that come through the museum also, and they don't get past that room. They're like, I got to leave. I've had women just break down crying. And,
at that van.
Yeah, and I mean, it's uncontrollable crying. I mean, it's interesting
too, because that van is just kind of like a Volkswagen.
Mm-hmm.
Bus looking. It's not very evil looking. It's just a normal van.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But,
so would you think that maybe some of the spirits and I don't know, people that were that died in that van would be around?
There's a lot of energy in that room.
Energy.
A lot.
Yeah,
a
it
lot.
Has to be. I mean, when you think about, you know, it's heavy enough, I think, when you visit something that you know is a death site of someone, especially if it's somebody that's significant to you or significant to history. But if you knew there was one location, like that van in that big, you know, it's a Volkswagen microbus. If there was one location where dozens and dozens, I mean, countless, and the we know the number is that high, the exact number is a little debatable, just because, again, this was all being done under the radar. But, you know, dozens and dozens, upwards of 100 probably, in that van. If you knew that something had happened just in that one spot over and over and over again, you know, there's a concept called stone tape theory, which is, you know, if something, we have, for example, Thomas Edison's writing desk inside the museum, and, you know, where many of his inventions were created, he's writing on that desk, so he's making an impression in the wood with these thoughts and energy. So to draw that correlation, if you had another place like that van where maybe, you know, merciful but still tragic deaths had taken place over and over and over again in that same spot, you're going to make a real impression right there.
Coming in from how Zach was able to get that one, was that something that was part of an auction as well?
So that one, to my understanding, was actually came from a salvage yard. Now, Jeffrey Feiger, who was, he's still alive, and you'll see from time to time, he's a lawyer that will often commentate on famous cases. He was Jack Kevorkian's attorney. And he, Zach interviewed him for an episode of the Deadly Possession Show. And you see a clip of this when you're on the tour and you're in the museum. But Jeffrey Feiger is there confirming that that is the van. Hmm. Now, he thought prior to Zach acquiring it that that van had been destroyed, only to find out that it hadn't been. And he knew, I mean, when I talk about the provenance, you know, and the authentication of the items here in the museum, before anything goes on display, it goes through painstaking verification. If you look at the crime scene photos, for example, of the van, the exact dents, the exact paint chips, the exact, you know, deteriorated areas of the van. And Feiger himself, who was dealing directly with Kevorkian, looked it over and verified all that.
There was something that was really interesting to me. It's right outside of James Dean's transaxle. There's some jackets there. Is it some Michael Jackson jackets? Or what is, there's something right there.
So what we've got in that area, that's the Hollywood exhibit, right? So we have a jacket that belonged to, well, it was the wardrobe that Robin Williams wore in the film What Dreams May Come.
Right.
Next to that is a jacket that Brandon Lee wore during the production of The Crow, which, of course, is the film that he lost his life on. The Michael Jackson item that you're thinking about is a chair that was next to the bed that Michael Jackson died in.
That's
and that chair is referred to as the propofol chair because that is where his doctor, Conrad Murray, would sit every night. Again, you want to talk about an impression of energy.
Right.
That doctor sitting in that same chair every night administering that propofol to Michael Jackson. And in fact, when the crime scene was investigated, the death scene, crime scene, that there was an empty canister of propofol underneath that chair. Hmm. If you look at the chair very closely, you'll see makeup stains from Michael Jackson that are still on the chair. And there's a crime scene photo. You'll see the chair right next to the bed where his body was found.
So some of those items, like obviously you mentioned the wardrobe that Robin Williams had and that sort of thing, that's not necessarily a haunted item. That's just more of just something kind of like, oh, wow, that's interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, I your perspective, Virginia, but I think, again, with energy, you know,
I think personally it's different with Sharon Tate's wedding dress, though. Sometimes I walk in there and I'll just get a feeling of just sadness, just like, God, you know, this woman died in such a horrific way. And then James Dean's transaxle is my favorite artifact in the entire museum. I love it.
Sharon Tate's wedding dress is an interesting one to bring up because that's part of our Hollywood exhibit as well. So in her case, of course, the most famous victim of the Manson family, you're talking about an item that within the span of a year was worn at her wedding, you know, presumably the happiest day of her life. And 1 year later, that dress was hanging in a closet probably just feet from where she was murdered. It was in the house at CLO Drive when she was murdered. So, you know, light and dark. I mean, you want to talk about something that has these incredibly happy memories attached to it only a year later to witness a horrific murder like that. So, yeah, we have that as well.
Now, I had a pretty... Since that's James Dean's transaxle is your favorite, I'll tell you about an experience I had in there. It was pretty amazing. When I first saw it, I couldn't stop crying. I was like, how am I going to present this? Because we had to, you know, verbally present it when we first got it. And I just cried through each presentation. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to go in and I'm going to say, good morning, James Dean. And when I leave, if there isn't a group in there, I'm going to say, good night, James Dean. The next morning, I went in there, and I said, "Good morning, James Dean." And the whole room filled with cologne. I smelled it. I was like, "Oh my God."
Wow.
I got goosebumps right now talking about it. And we looked up the kind of cologne he wore. It was French cologne from 1934. And I thought, man, there's probably no way they still make it. So we went to the mall and asked them, and they're like, "Yeah, we still have it." I'm like, "Can I have a sample? Can I smell it?" It was the same scent. Wow. And then about a month and a half later, I went into that room and said good morning again, and I smelled it just to faint. And I have witnesses. One of the girls that worked there walked by, and I yelled at her to come here and just smell this room. And then manager, Mike, mm-hmm. I told him, I say, come here, smell this. And they're like, "Yeah, we do smell it." And I was like, yes.
It's incredible.
I'm so glad. That was amazing.
And things like that do happen.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in high school, you'll appreciate this. We had a Ouija board, and we're like, "Let's try and like talk to Randy Rhoads."
Mm.
And long story short, a blonde hair fell like from the ceiling, and there was no one there with long blonde hair. And you can say what you want; you can be a doubter, but just like you smelled the cologne, I saw fucking Randy Rhoads' piece of hair. I saw it. I can still see it in my mind's eye. And what could it possibly be? It's probably someone was here before. But it's like, no, those sorts of things, the physical mm-hmm. evidence, like you said, you can smell it.
Yeah.
Has there been other examples of that at all ever in the museum that you can think of?
Yeah. Sometimes in the Dybbuk box room, I'll smell like a flowery smell. And sometimes when I'm in there, I'll smell cat urine. I hate that when I smell cat urine in there, because that's one of the deals that is connected to the Dybbuk box.
Yeah.
Is, well, you smell, and I hate that. I'm like, okay, time to get out of this room.
The smell.
The previous owners said.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. And not because they had a cat.
Yeah. Like, right. I've had things happen to me in that room that I never want. I was a level of paranormal I wasn't prepared for. I never want to see anything like that ever again. And every time I talk about it, I'm like, yeah, it was bad. I couldn't go in that room for 3 weeks.
Even as a guide, you can't go in?
I couldn't. I was like, I'll go. I can't do it.
Virginia will actually, so there's, if you remember from the tour, Chris, there's a video that plays in an adjacent room, an antechamber, that kind of gives you the whole story of the Dybbuk box and all that. And then if you choose to, you can go in and view it. And not everyone does. I should say, if anybody's hearing this and they've never been to the Haunted Museum before, and maybe they're thinking, man, this sounds too heavy for me. It's right. A lot of the exhibits are voluntary. So it's not, you don't have to feel bad at all. It's not unusual that somebody might choose to, you know what, I'm going to sit this one out. I'll just wait outside with the tour guide, that's perfectly mm-hmm. fine. But in Virginia's case, I know she waits outside. She'll present the Dybbuk box when it comes time to bring the people in, but she doesn't even want to wait in the room.
I'll start the video, close the door, and I'll wait by the stairs. I mm-hmm. will not stay in that room
by
myself.
Mentally and probably physically taxing on you to be here every day as a guide for some of these things that you're feeling.
You know what? There's never a day that I go into the Dybbuk box room and I'm like, oh, it feels nice in here today. It's always like you get like something is lurking,
mm-hmm.
you know, and after what I saw in there, I always walk through there like this. And I know Zach is like, you know, one of his deals is don't be scared, because they feed off of that. Sometimes it's really hard, you know, not to go in there and just have the feeling of just like, ugh. Yeah, because I'll see like a dark shadow that looks like one of the managers. I call it Shadow Mike. And I'm like, whoa. It was almost... I went almost a year and a half. That's the first thing that ever happened to me. Let me back up. That's the first thing that I ever saw in that museum. Because the managers, they would wear top hats. And I remember bringing a group into... I opened the door to go into the Dybbuk box. There was a dark shadow crouched down behind the Dybbuk box. Looked like it had a top hat on. Jumped up and ran out. I was like, whoa. I was like, oh my God, Mike scared the hell out of me. And then when I saw him in the break room, I said, Mike, you scared the hell out of me. He goes, when? I said, when you were in the Dybbuk box room and you jumped up and ran out. And he goes, I wasn't in there. Oh, wait a minute.
Just to give you an idea of the magnitude of that kind of experience too. I mean, you know, that particular time, I went up to, you know, Virginia was on the radio. All the guys have radios, right, with the earpieces. You know, we communicate that way. And she's on the radio, but in a panic, you know, just hysterical. And running up there to get her and try to lead her out of the room and let's get outside. She, you know, she had no idea who I was, and we'd probably known each other a year at that point. I mean, if you could just imagine somebody that you're that close to, and I'm saying, no, it's me. We're okay. It's me. And that person has no idea who you are.
And I was told what I was saying. I was told what I was doing. Mm-hmm. The only thing I remember is looking over and seeing the only thing it could have been was a demonic entity. It was gray and ashy, burnt looking. It had narrow eyes, no mouth, and it said something to me. But after it said something, it's like, I don't remember. I didn't pass out. I didn't lose consciousness. I don't remember anything. And some of the people are just like, yeah, you were holding on, saying, I don't want to open my eyes. I don't want to see it. I don't want to open my eyes. I don't remember that. Yeah. I don't remember that at all.
And we, you know, we've had some people. Virginia's our longest tenured guide here at the museum, and you know, we've had some people who, you know, don't make it that long. Not for everybody.
Yeah.
And so there have been other people who have come in and felt energies and had experiences like that dip out pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one nice thing about Virginia is as much as she is a magnet for this stuff, she's also reliable.
As I said, I couldn't go back in that room for a while. And then one day I was driving into work and I got really mad at myself. I said, you know what? I'm tougher than this. I can do this. I'm going back in that room. And I showed up to work and I said, I'm going back in the Dybbuk box. And they were like, really? I was like, yeah. Oh, well, we have cameras. I'm like, don't tell me you have cameras and you watch me. Don't say that. I said, just let me go in there. And if I feel heaviness in that room, I close my eyes and I know where everything is to point to it. And of course, I know everything to say. And then when I'm done, I'm like, let's go say hi to Peggy. Yeah.
Let's talk as we start to about some of the serial killer artifacts that you have. And there's a lot of them. And actually, Ed Gein's cauldron, of course, who is the original Leatherface. Talk about that. I also want to talk about Gacy's artwork and some of the other stuff that you have. There's some Manson stuff. There's some Bundy stuff.
Yeah. You know, Ed Gein, if you don't know the name, you'll definitely know the influence, as you mentioned. He was a guy who lived in Plainfield, Wisconsin, in the 1950s, and he was a loner. He pretty much had his mother as his best friend, and that was about it. And if that sounds like Norman Bates, that's because he was the inspiration for the movie Psycho. Exactly. Yeah. And his mother died, and it really sent him over the edge, and he started grave robbing. And he would dig up women in the local cemetery there in Plainfield, Wisconsin, and he would make artifacts and clothing out of their skin and their bones and their remains. He made a women's skin suit that he could wear to feel closer to her, which again, Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. And he was there was a cauldron in his barn where these horrific acts were taking place, and he was putting, you know, the entrails and the remnants of the corpses that he was exhuming into this cauldron. We have the cauldron, the very cauldron, at the museum that was originally sold at his estate auction there in Plainfield. Everything was auctioned out of the barn. But, you know, that is an example, just to paint a little picture for anybody who has not been to the museum. One of the things I'm always really proud of when guests see the museum is the attention to the detail and the design of all the exhibits. So, yes, the centerpiece of that exhibit is that cauldron and all the energy that that possesses. But when you walk into that room, you are walking into a Midwestern barn in the 1950s. The floors creak, the beams are exposed, the actual shovel that Ed Gein used to exhume those bodies is hanging in the rafters because we have that shovel as well. So that, would you feel the energy from that cauldron if you were just in a bare room with four walls? I'm sure you would to some degree, you know. But We do way better than that because the exhibits are immersive. So when you walk in there, we're taking you back in time. We're putting you in that place just the same way we do with the James Dean exhibit, where we put you on that lonely stretch of California highway back in the 1950s. Yeah.
Women usually get picked on in that room, but lately, at least on my tours, the guys have been getting poked and jabbed and stuff in that room.
Oh, wow.
So I'm just like, wow, this is kind of different.
A farmhouse. What about some of the Gacy stuff? Because he was an artist, shall we say. You got a lot of those types of paintings. And once again, is Zach getting this cauldron? You said it was at an auction. What about these paintings? I'm sure this stuff is all pretty highly sought after by collectors.
Yeah, so for example, you're right. We have a number of Gacy items, including the last pack of cigarettes that he ever smoked before he was headed to lethal injection. Those came directly from his stepdaughter, Tammy. The Ted Bundy items that we have, which include the murder kit that was found.
That's insane. The murder kit.
Yeah.
How did you get that?
That came from the detective on the case. That sort of thing, I think, is probably more closely monitored now than it would have been in the past,
right.
You know. But, because crime scene items, you know, it's like anything else. No matter how famous the case, the police department where it happened, they've got to clear room out because there's going to be more murders and crimes and that sort of thing.
A
lot of times, that sort of thing typically would be released to, like, next of kin or something like that. Or in Tammy's case, with Gacy, he just gave her the pack of cigarettes. We've got that, some personal cards, birthday cards, things like that, that he sent to her, which that's kind of, when you look at these things, for me, from either a historical aspect or even just the, what can you glean from this that is worthy of note? I think it's when you look at, say, the birthday cards that he wrote for her, you're seeing somebody who appears to be just kind of a loving, doting stepfather. And, of course, she knew none of this was going on at the time.
Fool everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think just from a sociological standpoint, there's value in that, just to look at that and say, okay, this person wasn't just walking around with a red flag on top of their head and everybody knew what was happening.
Right.
those items, the Gacy items, as I mentioned, Richard Ramirez, his urn is in the true crime exhibit, the Night Stalker, that came directly from his wife, the woman that he married while she was in prison. A little bit of the residue of his ashes are in there. They were scattered, but the urn is in there. And that urn has had some pretty heavy activity attached to it as well. In fact, the tag, I don't know if you know, when somebody is cremated, they put a piece, it's a metal tag that's in there that has your identification on it, because even after they cremate you, that's the evidence and it goes in the urn, right? Because it doesn't burn.
Right.
That tag, and there's an account that she gave Zach of this, of that tag popping off on its own off of that urn. And you'll see the tag in there as well as her handwritten account of how it happened.
Yeah, I mean, once again, just the Bundy murder kit is so crazy, because he did have the kit. Describe what was in there.
Ski mask, ice pick, ties to bind someone up, trash bags. And you would think, looking at that, whoever, the state trooper that pulled him over would say, okay, something bad's happening here, but it's not direct evidence. It doesn't, you may have that in the back of your car, but if they can't prove right then that you murdered somebody, you may not be headed straight to jail. So as it is well known in the case of Bundy, he had a lot of brushes with the law, near misses of getting arrested and things like that. And it was a good long while before the law caught up with him.
Last few things. Let's talk about Al Capone and the mirror.
Yeah.
Explain what the mirror is and what was happening with that mirror.
Yeah. So this is something else that has incredible provenance. These items were auctioned recently. We've had it about a year or so. But these items were given directly from Al Capone to his granddaughters. The granddaughters had these items right up until the time they sold them. So the Al Capone exhibit, which includes basically the bedroom furniture, the dresser, the mirror, the rug from his bedroom in Florida that he passed away in, is set up in an exhibit in the museum. And those items came directly from Capone to his granddaughters to Zach. No middlemen in between. So that's the lineage. And the fascinating thing about mirrors, and this is one of a couple of high-profile mirrors we have in the museum, the other one being one that belonged to Bela Lugosi. But you want to talk about something that captures energy. I mean, you know, how many times, you know, is your reflection reflected back to you in a mirror, especially one that's in your bedroom?
Right.
Now, add to the fact that it's, you know, likely capturing a death, because that's the room that you passed away in. And the real interesting story of Al Capone and the paranormal and haunting is that he was always thought to be responsible for the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Never prosecuted for it, but always thought to be responsible because seven members of a rival gang were lined up in front of a wall in Chicago and gunned down. And Al Capone, to the day he died, was haunted by the ghost of one of the victims of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It was a guy named Jimmy Clark. And there's testimony from his guards at Alcatraz, you know, once he was actually in prison, that he would be screaming at night, begging this ghost of Jimmy Clark to leave him alone. He used psychics to try to break that connection, never really seemed to get free of it, and quite possibly was haunted by it to his dying day. Wow. So you've got that mirror.
Right.
That, you know, not only captures most likely the last moments of Al Capone, but what was he seeing back? Was he seeing that ghost of Jimmy Clark that haunted him until his dying
right.
day?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of energy in that room as well with the mirrors?
Yeah, there is. I always look in it in hopes to see, like, Al Capone looking back. That would be a cool spirit to see. I'd be like... Yeah.
I'll tell you who was blown away by that exhibit was Rob Van Dam.
Oh, yeah.
He's a big mob guy.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
He wanted to spend a lot of time in there. Yeah.
So is there anything else that we haven't discussed, Virginia, that's in the museum that either has a lot of energy or something that kind of creeps people out or creeps you out?
Gosh.
I mean, there's so much stuff in
there. I know.
This is just a
personally,
cross-section
yeah.
of what's
oh,
in
yeah.
there.
Personally,
yeah.
I could tell you, Robert Berdella's room. I knew Robert Berdella.
So explain who Robert Berdella is.
Robert Berdella is the Kansas City butcher.
Oh.
He was a serial killer. And every time I go in that room and I see his face, I'm like, man.
You knew him?
Yeah.
How did you know him?
Kansas City is my old stomping ground.
Gotcha.
And he had a booth at the Westport Flea Market. And my friends and I went there all the time, talked to him all the time. Some of my friends bought stuff from him. And little did we know that when we were talking to him, he was going home and murdering, torturing these young men. And it's like, how the hell do you talk to somebody? And he was so personable. You know, we'd walk in, he'd be like, hey, guys, how you doing? Hey, Bob, how you doing? Everybody at the museum thinks it's funny because I say Bob. And that's how I knew him, Bob from the flea market. I didn't know him as Robert Berdella.
Right.
And... you know, just to think, was there any red flags or anything that we missed? There is nothing. It's just...
But like going back to the bed, you know, for me with Lamar Odom and Dennis Hoff, how about that? That
right.
Robert Berdella's crime scene
yeah.
appears where Virginia works, not in Kansas City, but in Las Vegas, Nevada, right?
I know. Right? I remember yeah. being in the break room and Zach was like, man, I got to get that Robert Berdella exhibit up, and I'm like, whoa, what?
Who?
Yeah.
And I was like, he's like, what? I said, I knew Bob Berdella. He was like, what? And I told him, and he was like, man, he goes, your tours in there are going to be awesome.
So I'll tell you about the item that is coming to the museum.
I was just
that
gonna,
I
yeah,
told
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the scoop. And you're such a pro, Chris. We teased it at the beginning of the podcast, and we waited to the end to reveal it.
Oh,
we're keeping people
my
listening.
Final question.
No, it's great. So, yeah, this is the first time we're putting this out anywhere because we just acquired this item, so your listeners are hearing about it first. But Zach has acquired the actual exorcism box that was used in a very famous exorcism case, a German girl named Annalise Michel. And this is the basis for the Possession of Emily Rose movies.
Oh, wow.
So if you know those. Yeah, so this is the real life story. It's the exorcism box. It's all the contents of the box. And it's a lot of the things that were associated with it. This box is... I mean, it was built in the late 1800s, so you're talking, you know, about something that is an incredible antique in its own right, but this is going to have its own exhibit, and we don't know what's going to happen. Oh, I mean, it will be it'll be ready in the maybe even by the time the podcast comes out, you know, for guests to view.
So you're actually getting you said a box.
Or it's the exorcism box. So when so when a priest would perform an exorcism, sort of like we were talking about the Dybbuk box earlier, there is a wooden box that has instruments that they will use, holy instruments, rosaries, you know, this type of thing, things that will contain the holy water and all that, and so contained within that box are those items. And this is the actual box that was used in that exorcism, as I said, along with there's actual audio recording of the exorcisms that we will feature in the exhibit as well. So yeah, Virginia's crossing herself over here.
Thank you, the sign of the cross. Yeah. Here we go.
But yes, I mean that's the daily existence of being at and working in the Ana Museum. You know, is I just wait to get that call from Zach that goes, "Hey, dude, check this out. Look what we're getting. Look what I just got." You know, and so you know, hopefully your listeners by the time they hear this, Halloween's a great time to come to the Ana Museum. Sure. It's like our Christmas season. Absolutely. So I think we'll have that new exhibit ready for our Halloween guests.
Yeah. Last question. We've discussed many, many things. What's your favorite artifact in the museum? Like I said, for me, it's James Dean's transaxle.
That's mine.
Yours
James
as well?
Dean's transaxle from Little Bastard. Now, I can tell you my second favorite.
Please do.
In the Ghostbuster room where he has like the movie artifacts.
Yeah.
One of the greatest depictions of Dracula was Bram Stoker's Dracula, where Gary Oldman played Dracula,
yeah.
And Zach has the cane, little blue eyeglasses, and prosthetic teeth. I love that. Yeah, but my other favorite one, he is not in the museum anymore. It was Bonnie and Clyde's tackle box. He had that.
Yeah,
so.
That was in the car, in the death car, when they were ambushed.
Yeah, so it's not in there anymore.
Yeah, that's something else we should point out too. Exhibits rotate in and out.
Sure.
You know, that's one thing I always like for guests to understand is, you know, they'll come sometimes and I think they assume it's like a movie. Mm-hmm. You see a movie once and it ends the same way every time. The Haunted Museum is exactly the opposite. The museum changes all the time. Zach is constantly collecting and our biggest problem is running out of room. So we're rotating new exhibits in all the time. And I kind of imagine a 60-day rule with this. I always tell people, I think if you come to the Haunted Museum 60 days after whenever your last visit was, you're going to see one or two new items probably, but sometimes whole new exhibits. You know, like that we just talked about the Possession of Emily Rose exhibit. I mean, that's an example that, you know, and that it doesn't take very long for those to come up. As soon as a new item comes in, Zach is so excited about getting it going. And, you know, he's the hardest working guy I've ever been around. So when you get that call, he's like, "Let's meet up at the museum." So we'll work all night and we'll get it ready for guests tomorrow.
I always get excited about presenting new stuff. Yeah. And now this Emily Rose thing, it's like this, but it's like that too. It's like, yay. And then it's like, oh boy, I wonder what's going to happen in there.
Me, you know, this may surprise you. A lot of people may not even know this story, but I am fascinated by the Jerry Lewis exhibit in the Hollywood room, Jerry Lewis, famous comedian, Martin Lewis, Nutty Professor, but specifically because it is tied to a movie that he made called The Day the Clown Cried that no one has ever seen because it was so horrible. He canned it immediately. So quickly, the story, he made a film in the early 1970s that is, he directed, produced, starred in, he portrays a clown in a Nazi concentration camp who is entertaining children as they are being led to the gas chambers.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, occasionally you will hear someone who has seen this thing, like Harry Shearer, for example, Derek Smalls in Spinal Tap. He's seen it. And I heard him telling the story on Howard Stern one time. And he's like, "I just can't describe how bad this, you know," he's like, "it starts off horrible and it gets worse. So I think it's something about, we have the props, the costumes he wore, the fake teeth that he wore in it, some of the other props, some of the camera bags, some other things. But just, I think that's such a fascinating, weird story.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of weird, you know, like, tell me how this whole thing played out. You know, this guy was on top of his profession and he made this horrible mistake, right? So anyway, but we tell that story and you see these items and, you know, one of these days, if that film ever sees the light of day, you'll be like, I actually saw the props that were involved in it.
Well, this is a great place and so many cool things to see and come check out. Thanks to you guys for kind of opening the door and explaining it all.
Anytime.
Yeah.
Back in and look at some of them again.
Really enjoyed it. You're welcome anytime. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, guys.